The wait is over. New episodes of The Walking Dead Season 10 are premiering early February 21st on AMC+. Don't miss the extended 10th season featuring 6 new episodes, each focused on fan-favorite characters. Prepare for all new high-stakes showdowns and emotional reckonings by catching up on the latest season before new episodes drop. With season binges, exclusive content, and early access to new episodes, the best Walking Dead experience is only on AMC+. Get lost in the Walking Dead universe today, available ad-free and on demand. Sign up at amcplus.com. AMC+, only the good stuff.
Hey, it's Mark Roberts. This is Let's Get Into Entertainment.
The business of entertainment.
David, it's the business of entertainment.
It is.
You know what's crazy about entertainment now is that everything is changing. Before, as independent filmmakers, we had the opportunity to go to festivals and see the people and have people buy tickets to your movie and advertise and do grassroots.
Even screenings.
Yeah, screenings are gone, right? So now you don't have any of that. You have festivals going virtual. I don't even know what that means. Today, we're going to talk to Paul Espinoza, who is from San Diego. He has a PhD from Stanford University in anthropology.
Interesting.
With a specific eye on film, television, and how it affects people. I mean, that is anthropology. Mm-hmm. But he's a fellow San Diegan, and he runs the San Diego Latino Film Festival.
I love that.
Which I believe just went off. So we're going to talk about film festivals. We're going to talk about how your indie film is now affected by this. If it's affected at all, maybe it's a positive thing. I don't know. But Paul's going to let us know a little bit about that. We'll talk about Tootie's movie. And I've got a big announcement to make that I wasn't able to say before about Netflix and a film that I just finished up. Perfect. We'll talk about all that when we get back. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Let's Get Into Entertainment.
The business of entertainment.
What's up?
Dude, we got to jump right into it right now because I've got an announcement. Carlos Almaraz, Playing with Fire, which I have been producing for a number of years with Elsa Almaraz and with Richard Montoya and with Richard Alarcon. You know, we've been...
Rich, that's my guy.
We've been in the trenches.
Yeah.
Get a load of this. About a month ago, Netflix says, I want to pick this up. And more importantly, a guy named Rodrigo Maison, who works at Netflix, watched this movie and agreed that it was an important film. It's not a Netflix original, but it is a licensed Netflix movie that's going to be on Netflix for 10 years, all over the world.
For 10 years?
Yeah, over the world.
That's pretty good.
All over the world. It's an amazing thing that Carlos Almaraz is going to be premiering on Netflix. After this podcast airs, it will premiere on Netflix. So we're talking about Thursday, October 1st, Carlos Almaraz, Playing with Fire, is on Netflix in every Latin American country, in Spain as well. And then later on, it's going to be in the around the world. But it was such a passion play, you know? I had to stick with it for years and years and years.
Sounding like an indie producer right now. Listen,
I had to stick with it for years and years and years under all kinds of turmoil, under all kinds of complications. but you know, there was good investors. They were very involved with it being finished. The director stood strong with it for all these years, and ultimately, I'd have to say that the most important factor in the film was Richard Alarcon. Without Richard Alarcon, I don't know that we make it.
No. All right. So are we toasting or what? You said you started off this whole piece about, I'm going to give a toast.
All right. I'd like to propose a toast to independent film, the independent spirit, documentaries about socially important people and subjects, and the idea that if you stick with it, that sometimes great things happen.
Salud.
Not over the mixer, though.
Not over the mixer. Come
Cheers.
On.
Cheers, guys. So this is a celebration for independent filmmakers, independent film, and also telling stories that clearly matter to a lot of people. And when people watch Carlos Almaraz playing with fire. They will see something that they wish they had known, or they'll wonder why they didn't know it. And if a film can make you say that, then it was worth making.
You know what that is, Davey Dave? That's high concept.
I love it. You're full of it.
You know,
full of high concept.
Come on, look at it. Now he takes a big drink of his torpedo and smiles.
Look at the twinkle in his eye.
Eating grin right now.
Dude.
With all that said, we should get on the phone with another
Let's do it.
Independent film producer who's really accomplished as well.
He's an award-winning filmmaker. He's a fellow San Diegan,
I
understand. And here's another thing you don't hear much about filmmakers is that he's got his degree in anthropology.
Yeah.
Which is pretty crazy, from Brown University.
Perfect. There you go.
Can you hear it?
Yeah. If you can hear it ringing.
Why is it? It's kind of...
Rod?
Paul?
Yeah.
Hey, how you doing, bud?
Good, good. How you doing?
Mark Ice Roberts and Davey Dave.
Hey.
Hey, how you doing?
Did you grow up in San Diego?
No. I grew up in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, and basically came to California in the early 70s. It was around 74, wow. Basically. But I've been in...
Good tax credits out there.
Yeah. Well, they are now. At that time, there was nothing like that. But yeah, they've really ramped up film production there since in the last 25 years. It's definitely become a really good place to film. And of course, they have tremendous locations of all sorts within a short distance. But yeah, I grew up in Albuquerque, but came to California, I think around 74. And then I've been in California most of the rest of that time, a good chunk of the time. A fair amount of it. I've been in San Diego since the late 70s, so I've been in San Diego quite some time also.
Hey, so just so our listeners know what we're talking about here, you have been making movies, but in addition to making movies, you also run the San Diego Latino Film Festival.
Well, I don't run it. I'm basically on the board of the Media Arts Center of San Diego, and the Media Arts Center is the nonprofit organization that runs the film festival. I was one of the founders of the organization, and we've been running. Actually, we just finished our 27th annual film festival this past Sunday.
I feel like the movie I made, Carlos Almaraz Playing with Fire, played at the Latino Film.
Oh yeah,
San Diego Film Festival last year.
Definitely, yeah, it definitely played. I didn't realize that was your film. I know Richard very well. In fact, I saw him. He was with the film actually in San Antonio at Cine Festival.
That's right. That's right.
But yeah, your film was definitely here last year. And
we're celebrating on this particular show because the film has been bought by Netflix and it starts premiering on Thursday, October 1st. So.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Wonderful. Yeah. Congratulations.
So the San Diego Film Festival should take credit for that.
That's right, Robert. Good recognizing.
Thank you.
Respect.
Yeah. You know, you're an important board member and you recommend films and are involved with the process, right?
Yeah, to some extent. Some more than others. But yeah, basically, yeah, we basically really keep the organization going. And then, you know, the film festival is, well, the Media Arts Center is a year-long effort. We actually have a small independent theater that we run also in San Diego that we've been running for about the last 8 years now, mostly small independent films, a lot of Latino films, but it's called the Digital Gem Cinema. And anyway, and then our biggest offering is the annual Latino Film Festival, which, as I mentioned, is just finished its 27th year. In my humble opinion, it's actually one of the best Latino film festivals in the country. Very, very well run, very well organized. And of course, we have so many people love to come to the festival, especially filmmakers who've come in the past, and they know, you know, that there's usually a very enthusiastic audience for these films. The executive director of the Media Arts Center is Ethan Bonfilo, and he's just done a remarkable job of keeping the organization going and just, you know, making it happen, and a really appreciative audience here for just wonderful films. So as you know,
yeah,
so many of these films basically won't be seen anyplace else, sadly, you know, with some exceptions, but and we really, you know, obviously we're producing, we Latinos are producing a huge amount of work that really needs to be seen by much larger audiences.
I agree that the Latino Film Festival in San Diego is very well run. It's a beautiful festival. So you guys definitely Anyone have a film out there? You should definitely submit. What movies have you made? What are you most proud of?
I've basically been primarily a documentary filmmaker, but I've been doing that for now over 40 years. Some of the more well-known films that I've made are, one is The Lemon Grove Incident, which is a film about one. It's a hybrid film. It was made in 1985, and it's a documentary with a lot of reenactment. It has actually more reenactment than documentary, but it's about one of the earliest school desegregation cases in the United States. It happened in 1930. It was the first successful challenge to segregation any place in the country. It involved Mexican-American children. The Mexican-American community sued the school board in Lemon Grove to prevent the school board from segregating their children. Anyway, it's a film that, you know, tells that story. We interview a lot of the people who were students at the time, and they talk about their memories of this incident, which, you know, was hardly known, really didn't make it into the historical record very much, but, you know, was a really important victory for people that were relatively new to the United States even then. This was during the Depression, one of the very first massive repatriations, the repatriation of Herbert Hoover in the 1930s, that led to almost a million Mexican and Mexican Americans being repatriated, deported basically, in that period. So the Lemon Grove Incident is one film that a lot of people know. Another film that I produced is And the Earth Did Not Swallow Him, which is a film, it's an adaptation of a novel by the same name by Tomas Rivera. That was, he was actually the chancellor at the University of California, Riverside. He was the highest ranking Mexican American in the University of California system, and actually the only chancellor for many, many years. But anyway, it's a memoir about growing up as a migrant farm worker in the 1950s. And it's a beautiful novel. It's a novel that, you know, got a lot of attention, has won a lot of prizes, and it was, you know, adapted for a film. It was basically done for American Playhouse. American Playhouse was the drama series on public television. It's now no longer around. For that, I've done several films for the American Experience, one called The Hunt for Pancho Villa, about Pancho Villa's raid on Columbus, New Mexico in 1916, and the American expedition led by John Pershing that goes after him, spends a year in Mexico without catching sight of Pancho Villa, and declares victory and leaves. Like I say, in San Diego, most of my professional career, and really have done a lot of work on the U.S.-Mexico border region. You know, I did another big series on the war between Mexico and the United States, the war of 1846 to 1848. That was a four-hour series for public television and also for Canal 11 in Mexico City. And basically the first, you know, examination of that war for television that had ever been done, very, you know, important historical moment that, again, many people are not familiar with. That, for instance, the land that, as you and I speak, all of this used to be part of Mexico. Anyway, that's I think, a very important series that really gives some historical perspective about, you know, how all this territory became part of the United States.
All of those movies sound amazing. Are they available to be watched anywhere?
Well, some of them are. I mean, basically, if people are interested, they can go to my website, which is Espinosa Productions. It's Espinosa with an S, Estinosa, EspinosaProductions.com. You can see information about a lot of the work that I've done and little clips of some of the films. And then there's also ways of contacting me. There's some of them. Well, a lot of my films are in university collections. Not too many of them are, you know, like, for instance, on Netflix or anything like that, at least at this point.
The time has come where a lot of the information that are in those movies are valuable to viewers. You know, people are really demanding to know more about what happened, during lots of walks of life. So this is that's an amazing array of important films. So congratulations to you.
Yeah, thank you.
So you studied anthropology?
Yeah, I studied anthropology.
Because, you know, I know a guy who teaches anthropology and is an anthropologist who lives on the border in Brownsville.
Yeah.
And his study of anthropology is really the study of the people that live on the border and, you know, how they live, what they use for medicine and you know, all kinds of interesting stuff. What was the thing that you focused on as an anthropology major?
Yeah. Well, basically, my study. Well, I did. My bachelor's was done at Brown University in Rhode Island in Providence, but I did my graduate studies at Stanford. And you know, usually what you do as an anthropologist is you go someplace far, far away and you study what the natives do. Like the friend you're talking about who studied, maybe he was from there, but a lot of times anthropologists study other cultures, like, you know, American Samoa or someplace in some remote area of Latin America. And you study what the natives do, but you spend, you know, what they call a long-term participant observation with the community and find out, you know, how they do things. Well, I decided that I was going to study the natives in Hollywood. And I went to Hollywood, a little town not too far from, well, actually, you guys are right there, I think, in Hollywood. And I basically conceived of a television studio as a little village. And I looked at how they went about creating a television series. The way that, you know, some natives in other parts of the world, they create songs, they create pots, they work on cultural artifacts. Well, these natives were working on a television series and looked at how they went about creating it, not so much from a technical point of view, but more from a cultural point of view. How do they take culture and massage it and manipulate it and turn it into a television series? The series that I worked on, this was in sort of the late or mid to late 70s. And I was trying to get into a television series that worked on creating ethnic characters, because I felt like so many of the television series you saw were so, I don't know, there were just a lot of stereotypes at that time. Of course, even now there's a lot of stereotypes. But I thought it'd be interesting to know, well, how do these shows get created? What do these people know about the communities that they're representing? Well, I had a very difficult time. If I was, you know, coming in saying I wanted to study how people were creating ethnic characters was not the conversation didn't last too long with Hollywood producers. But anyway, through kind of a lot of, you know, talking and introducing myself, I knew nobody in Hollywood. I was completely an outsider, which probably actually in retrospect was an advantage. But I finally reached Gene Reynolds, who was the co-creator of MASH with Larry Gelbart, and also was himself, actually later was the president of the Directors Guild of America. But anyway, he was creating a new television series, and I managed to get my foot in the door to sort of, you know, kind of watch what they were doing. The series was at Mary Tyler Moore Studios, and it was The Lou Grant Show, which was a television series done back in the 70s. And it was kind of interesting because, if you remember, Lou Grant was a character on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. He had been, he's an editor who comes to Los Angeles and becomes the editor of a fictional newspaper in Los Angeles. So this is a newspaper. Theoretically, a story about a newspaper that's covering all these stories, you know, out in the world, putting them into a newspaper, and they were creating a television show about a newspaper series. And I was an anthropologist studying them while they were doing this. So it was all these wheels within wheels. But anyway, yeah. I mean, it was an incredible experience. I mean, I didn't know these people at all. But not only was Gene Reynolds involved, but Jim Brooks and Alan Burns. Jim Brooks, who created the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and of course, Jim Brooks, who went on to be a, you know, director of great
legends.
And actually all these guys, one of the things that united them is they were basically writers. It was a point in television where writers were becoming producers, you know, and becoming like a producer hyphenate. And essentially they were, you know, gaining control of their own shows. Cause I think prior to that, you know, writers really didn't have that much power in the industry. It was like, you know, producers hired writers and got rid of them as quickly as they could. But anyway, it was kind of an interesting moment.
I think it's fascinating that that you could mix anthropology and entertainment. That's pretty trippy.
Yeah. Well, basically, I mean, like I say, it was kind of what anthropologists do. They study culture, and in this case, you know, I just was it was part of a process also at that time of taking anthropology and maybe focusing it not so much on powerless communities, which is what traditionally anthropology had done, but trying to look at more powerful communities, which, you know, is very challenging. A lot of times you don't have any access to that, but for whatever reason, I mean, I managed to do it. I'm sure it was like a once in a lifetime kind of thing because, just getting my foot in the door was very, very difficult. But somehow I managed to develop enough rapport with Gene Reynolds in particular, who definitely was very powerful. I mean, he was executive producer of the series. So once I had his buy-in, you know, everybody else, I just was just there. Oh, well, he's somebody that knows Gene. I guess he's fine, you know, being here. But I managed to, you know, sit in on lots and lots of story conferences and basically see the whole process of how television series get created, you know, much of which is pretty mundane, especially once at this point, the series actually had, it was just, they were trying to sell this. They hadn't even been sold yet to a network. So it was in a very early stage. They hadn't cast the show other than, the main character, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, it was very early in the process, which is exactly because I think if you go to a television series and study it, you know, in the fifth season, I mean, so many decisions have already been made, fundamental decisions about how they create stuff, you know?
Congratulations on all of the work that you've done. Congratulations on, the San Diego Film Festival. I think what I really wanted to get into for our listeners, just to sort of wrap up, is, a lot of us have relied on festivals to sell your movies. You know, I went to Sundance with Strangers with Candy in 2005, and it was an important festival for us. If had we not done that, it would have been very complicated to sell that movie, to create a buzz.
Right.
Now that it's virtual and you've experienced and also been part of setting up a film festival virtual, do you think was it as effective? Is it not as effective? What's your opinion about how that all went, and what's your opinion about how it helps or hurts the filmmaker?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I should say, I'm also, obviously a filmmaker, and I've also been actually participating in a number of virtual film festivals with my film, which is it's a Singing Our Way to Freedom. It's a documentary about a Chicano musician from the 1970s and 80s. Actually, it's really a biopic on his life in general. But anyway, I was doing lots of festivals, and then of course when COVID hit, I pretty much stopped having any screenings, but then started to do some virtual screenings. So I've been doing that somewhat over the last 9 months. But this festival we just finished in San Diego was completely virtual. It was actually planned as a regular festival. In fact, we had to close it down March the 12th, the day it was supposed to begin. That was the day that we had to cancel the festival, which was just heartbreaking. We already had a whole bunch of filmmakers in town, of course, had already spent a certain, money to get the festival organized, and then that went up in smoke. I would say, generally speaking, this festival, the virtual one that we just did, which was also a 11-day festival, and it had actually a lot of the films that we originally planned for March, we had, with the exception of a number of bigger films that, basically just moved on because they're distributors. A lot of the really big films, they're very... they don't like smaller festivals. I mean, which is understandable maybe, but they have their eye on Sundance and Toronto and the really big festivals.
Right.
But anyway, I think virtual festivals are still kind of feeling their oats, so to speak. I mean, I don't think in the long run they're going to be as effective as a regular festival. I mean, we had a good turnout. I actually haven't seen the final figures, but I'm sure the figures are not anywhere as good as they were for, a real festival. And again, like our festival, we've been doing it for 27 years. So one of the things about a festival is not just seeing the films, but, the whole ambience of people showing up and hanging out, and especially people that have been going to the festival, year after year, there's a whole, exchange that goes on, and people love that. They love to, see the films, talk to the filmmakers, meet them in person, just kind of hang out. It's very, and obviously in a virtual world, you can't really have that. That said, I mean, we did have a lot of really great, we had many, many Q&As, virtual Q&As. One of the things that allowed is we had filmmakers probably that normally wouldn't have been able to, so quote, come to the festival, but they were, they were all over the place, all over the world, really, but they could come in and, talk about their film after the thing. And that was, I think, very effective. Again, I don't know if I would say it was more effective than a typical Q&A live, right? So I don't know. I guess the jury is still out on that. And again, we don't know how long we're going to be doing virtual festivals. I think most of us hope that this is, maybe in another year, this is going to be a thing of the past, but we don't know. Yeah. We don't really know.
Yeah. That's where you mingle and you meet people. And
Yeah. I agree that we're at the sort of beginning stages of trying to make these virtual things work. But you know what? Independent filmmakers need a place to show no matter what's happening. We've raised money, we made a movie, people need to see these films. And I appreciate that you guys are out there making it happen regardless of the scenario. So really thank you for supplying the festival and making it available for everybody, all of us. Congratulations on a successful run on that. And I'm sure, hopefully we can get back to coming to festivals and openings and galas and all that kind of stuff. But in the meantime, we'll continue to support, festivals for doing what they do, which is show work that, wouldn't be seen otherwise. So thank you for that. Hey, so I have to ask you about, Rich Alarcon, which now has, who cut, Carlos Almaraz for me, and many other films, by the way, and is now working with our boy here, Rod Tootie Rinks, on Made in Mexico. How do you know Rich, and have you worked with him?
Well, no, I think we're talking about. I was talking about Richard Montoya.
Oh shoot! Okay, let's go back. Hang on a second.
But
I'm going to go back.
Yeah, but
he doesn't know Alarcon.
No, he doesn't. But Paul, you do know Rick Nahara, right?
Yeah. No, I know Rick Nahara and Richard Montoya. I know the Culture Clash very well. In fact, I did.
Hang on a second. Let me go back. Okay. Tip of the hat, the big tip of the sombrero to you and everyone involved with the San Diego Latino Film Festival. Really appreciate you. You know Richard Montoya. Richard Montoya is my partner in Water and Power, which I produced with him, and now we did Carlos Almaraz Playing with Fire, and of course he's from the legendary group Culture Clash, which is a super important voice in all of all things Latino. But how do you know him, and have you worked with him?
Yes, basically, you know, I know Richard well, and Herbert Siguenza and Rick Salinas, all of the three members of Culture Clash. Yeah, I did a 2-hour special for PBS called The Border back in 1999, and basically we did 6 stories of different all along the U.S.-Mexico border, and one of them was story about Border Town, which was a play that the Culture Clash had been commissioned to produce about a border town, about San Diego, Tijuana. And they, in their typical fashion of what they did, they basically interviewed lots and lots of people on both sides of the border, and they mounted a play about that. But I was doing a television series, a PBS series, a national series about the U.S.-Mexico border, and I thought it would be interesting to look at how artists were looking at the border and thinking about it and conceptualizing how it played a role in their work. And so I was sort of peering over their shoulders as they created Border Town. So that was a very nice segment that we did with them. Yeah. And actually, we wanted, and they had already done, you know, at least 6 different shows like that where they were commissioned, you know, in different parts of the country, you know, Miami and the Mission in San Francisco and other places. And we actually had hoped to do something where we would do more of that, you know, a whole series where they sort of do the different parts of America, you know, Culture Clash does America kind of, but anyway, we weren't able to raise the money for that. But anyway, I've known them since then, and we see each other at different times. I like I say, I saw Richard Montoya, he was down here also for the Carlos Almaraz film. I think it was last year, right?
It was last year, yeah.
And then I also saw him in San Antonio. He was at San Antonio Cine Festival, where I was also showing my film on Chunky Sanchez. And Herbert, I see, because Herbert's actually been the playwright in residence down here for the last 3 years with the San Diego Repertory Theater. So,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
I think the voice of Mexican Americans and immigrants and all these stories that are now coming out, and you know, look, by the way, you've been doing the stories for years and years and years. It's sort of just time, and there's people that are very interested in this now, and I just hope that all of the every film you've mentioned I really love to see.
Yeah.
So I just hope that it, you know, that even after all this time, those find homes and people can check them out. But it was a pleasure talking to you. You've done, you know, an amazing amount of work, and you've done a lot of good things, and I appreciate that you do the Latino Film Festival in San Diego, and I think everyone should check that out and submit. But anyway, dude, congratulations. Thank you for being on the show, and hopefully you can come back and tell us more about what's coming next.
Okay, sounds wonderful. Listen, I really enjoyed talking to you guys, so keep the faith, and we'll just keep going.
Thanks, buddy.
That's right, bud.
Okay. All right, talk soon. A couple things. I think what's true is that virtual festivals may not have figured out exactly how that works yet.
Well, there's this, look.
There's no way to quantify it.
No, because the traditional festival that we're used to is you go, you make deals there. People watch your movies.
Shake hands, you get drunk.
The whole, that you miss that social aspect. But as Paul was saying, that virtually now you could be anywhere in the world and go to that festival. You could watch that movie and you can interact. Now, being on a screen with a bunch of people isn't the same as standing next to somebody.
It's going
to
take a minute.
It's going to take a minute. And am I a fan of it? No, because I'm a social person, unlike you, Roberts, who likes just to sit at home and drink your Teremala.
Hopefully, we get back to normal and we get back to festivals and people get back into theaters. But thank you for suggesting him. I think he's a interesting, powerful person. Like, why not?
Just keep doing
what you can do.
Yeah, just keep going, most importantly.
Thank you guys for listening, and we will see you next time on Let's Get Into Entertainment.
The business of entertainment.
Sorry, Maddie.
Oh, come on, man.
No, come on, man.
The wait is over. New episodes of The Walking Dead Season 10 are premiering early February 21st on AMC+. Don't miss the extended 10th season featuring 6 new episodes, each focused on fan-favorite characters. Prepare for all new high-stakes showdowns and emotional reckonings by catching up on the latest season before new episodes drop. With season binges, exclusive content, and early access to new episodes, the best Walking Dead experience is only on AMC+. Get lost in the Walking Dead universe today, available ad-free and on demand. Sign up at amcplus.com. AMC+, only the good stuff.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Greetings from Ireland. This is a quick taste of what to expect from the Tommy and Hector with Loretta Blewett podcast.
There's rubbish and old hurlies and everything in the utility toilet. And I'd be sandwiched in there and I just go... And I can hear someone in the kitchen going, "I'm in here, by the way."
But I remember visiting your house as a teenager and none of your toilets had locks on the door. And I'd often be wandering out from the kitchen and hear your mother shouting out,
"I'm in here, by the way." Just let anybody who's passing know that I'm in here, by the way.
Listen to this show on the Acast app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast recommends.